From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone. Uhuru, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am your host, Hunter Dusing, down in the great state of Texas, where the economy is still good. And joining me is a man who you thought died in a plane crash, John Denver, but it's in fact John Grace. Say hello, John.
Yes. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
And our economy is doing very good because we legalized weed.
Yeah, everybody's moving to Denver.
Like, it angers me.
You need to build a wall.
We do.
Make America great again.
Yeah, we're going to make Denver great again.
Make
Colorado great. Fantastic.
Eat Denver omelets, listen to John Denver, and smoke weed.
Yeah, and Joe Walsh. We really love the James Gang, Rocky Mountain Way.
Fuck yeah, that's a great song.
It is. Classic rock staple.
Even Godsmack did a cover of it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the one Red Rock show I wish I could attend this summer is Joe Walsh, along with Bad Company, reunited with Paul Rogers.
Oh my God.
That would be my 70s rock and roll, you know, comeback right there.
Is Geddy Lee going to show up and go, they wanted us to be like Bad Company. This is what
As if that's a bad thing. I actually think Bad Company is actually pretty good.
Bad Company is not bad. I think Five Finger Death Punch tried very hard to ruin Bad Company.
Uh-huh.
They did that awful Bad Company cover that was all over the radio.
You know, if you get their second album, I think it's Burning Sky. It's actually a pretty cool, right? I mean, they were on the Swan Song label. They were not some super group.
No.
Or you know, they were hired by Jimmy Page. Some of those guys were like in Mott the Hoople before they were in Bad Company. They were a good band.
Speaking of Jimmy Page, I didn't realize that,
he fucked 12-year-olds?
He did that.
Yeah.
He fucked a lot of, underage women.
Yeah.
Besides that, I heard that he and like John Paul Jones and Jason Bonham auditioned Miles Kennedy to be in like not Led Zeppelin, but like a new band that would have basically the Led Zeppelin band, but with him as singing as the singer.
Really?
Which that was weird.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
It's not happening because the press thought they were replacing Robert Plant, and so.
Well, I'm young enough to remember when The Firm was putting out bad records, and then all the Zeppelin fans, which really seemed to grow in the 80s, you know, long after they broke up.
Well, that's the story.
Really, really hoping for a Zeppelin reunion when it would matter.
Well, and that's the story with all bands. Like, they get their audience when they're gone. Like, Faith No More, The Misfits, like, every punk band ever. Like, every...
Yeah, all punk bands like, except The Clash.
Except The Clash. The Damned, you know, I just watched that documentary on The Damned, and they've, you know, been very... They come back for a few years, and then they disappear, and Dave Vanian goes into his coffin for a few years.
I saw that documentary. I thought it was weird they didn't mention that Dave Vanian's wife actually played bass.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, she was...
For like 10 years.
Yeah, she was on the Grave Disorder record.
It's not even mentioned, because every time I saw them live in the early Double O's, she was always their bass player, and she was with them at least as far back as 95. So what the hell?
Yeah, I don't know. There were some things that were left out of it. I do want to like talk about that documentary more on the show, but I thought the documentary was good.
Yeah,
especially because the Damned were one of the first like non-contemporary punk bands I got into. Like, I got into them before The Clash, before the Sex Pistols, before any of them. You know, like, I was listening to, like, Green Day. And this kid on the bus, I remember I was taking the bus to work. And to school. And I listened to mostly Metallica and Green Day. That was all I listened to, pretty much.
You were a pretty typical young kid back then.
Pretty much. And and there was this kid on the bus who listened to punk cassette tapes. Like, he was the stoner, kind of weird kid. And he took the bus to school, but he didn't listen to CDs. He listened to cassettes because he was punk rock. And he goes, "What do you listen to, man?" Like, he was a really nice guy, but like a lot of guys, he likes to give you shit, you know?
Yeah.
Because he was like a year older than me. And right. We ended up working together at the grocery store. But, yeah, really good dude. But he goes, "So what do you listen to?" And I was like, "I like Green Day." And he goes, "So you like punk rock?" And I didn't know what punk rock was. You know,
right.
And I was like, "Is what?" He goes, "Green Day's punk rock." He goes, "Do you like The Damned?" And I was like, "No." And I go, he goes, "You got to listen to The Damned, man." And so I went to like Sound Warehouse or one of those stores, and I picked up Marvelous, The Best of The Damned, which didn't have any of the early stuff. It had like mostly stuff from like Machine Gun Etiquette and
right.
Like the Black Album and some B-sides. And I picked that up and, you know, thought they were awesome. But yeah, like, so I really love The Damned, and so getting a documentary on them, and I really have a new appreciation for Captain Sensible after seeing it, because he's pretty funny. But
oh yeah, he's a riot.
Yeah, he's really witty, like just a guy who always has like
he's got that something they teach in the British school system, I think.
I guess, and because I loved it, he said that when they got back together with Brian James and Rat Scabies. He said he fucked it up by when they were about to play like whatever the Guns N' Roses covered, like New Rose or Neat 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 or one of those. He goes, "Here's a song by Guns N' Roses." And Brian James got really pissed.
Yeah, he went on an anti-John Lennon rant the first time I saw them at the Blue
I love it when they're like, "I have this
John's dead. We miss John so much." One of those John Lennon tributes that aired on VH1 with everybody doing it. John Lennon. They go, "Oh, we love John so much. He's so wonderful." Because they have a song called "I Loved You Better Dead" or something like that. That's actually, he said it was about John Lennon.
I have this one live recording where they're about to play the song Neverland. He goes, "This one goes out to Michael Jackson, wherever he is. We love you, Michael. What do you think he got up to with Bubbles?"
Yeah, he's really funny. I found that documentary kind of uneven.
It is very uneven. It's not as good. It's by the people who did the Lemmy documentary.
And yeah, I didn't like that. I actually watched that and I didn't care for it. I thought it was hero worship.
Yeah, it is. It is hero worship. But it's by those. But the Lemmy documentary had more of a narrative, I thought. But
yeah.
This one, though, I liked it because I was getting a lot of stuff about a band I love. But I thought it focused a little too much on the Brian James years and the first Damn Damn Damned album. Like, it kind of made it seem like that record was the record. And to me, I mean, and this is just my experience, but I always preferred the Captain Sensible on guitar years. I always thought he was a more dynamic player.
Right.
And nothing against Brian James. I mean, Neat 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 and all those songs, like, you hear those and I want to fucking destroy the room because they're so awesome.
Right.
But, you know, but
my thing with the Damn was, like, I got into them in the early 90s when I was starting to get into punk rock. This is before Green Day was anything. This was like, I was so bored by grunge. I said, well, maybe I should just go listen to what was inspiring these. And I always liked punk music when I saw it on Night Flight. So I started, and luckily Ramones and all that stuff would be in the cassette cutout bins. So it was pretty easy to get into punk, like around 1990. Because that stuff was cut out label special, you know. And I was listening to The Damned, and they weren't the strongest. Like, I really preferred Stiff Little Fingers and Jam and some other groups from that time.
Screwdriver.
But, well, their first album's good, man. It's not racist.
Yeah. Come on.
Go listen to it on YouTube, and if you don't believe me, it's not racist, and it's actually better than The Clash.
Yeah, it's great. It's awesome. But then you listen to the next record, and you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah, but when they got all Nazi white power, they're pretty bad.
Yeah.
But in fact, the lyrics to a lot of – I have listened to a lot of that stuff, and the lyrics are a lot like the songs in Nashville. They just seem to kind of make up the tunes as they go along or something. You know, your white pride. You know,
white pride.
200 years of our white thunder or something, you know. It's like they're just making it up as they go along.
It almost seemed like they were trying to like corner a market or something.
The funny thing is, in the 90s, every interview with every punk band like Rancid and all those guys, the interviewer would always spot the Screwdriver records on their shelf. And then one of the guys at Rancid, I think it was either Tim Armstrong or Lars Ulrich. And Lars Ulrich was pretty bad about always posing as a big macho guy.
Fredrickson.
Frederick, Frederick.
Not the guy from Metallica.
I have literally forgotten Lars Fredriksson from a band I genuinely liked in the early days. No, but it's like Lars was, it might have been Tim Armstrong, like I said. They asked him, what are those screwdriver records doing on your shelf? He goes, well, you know, I listen to those. I'm not proud of it, but I kind of need to know what the enemy is up to.
Oh, sure.
It's like, all right, yeah, you enjoy it. Stealing the rights and stuff. And that's like when Viggo Mortensen's interviewed and he admits he's listening to right-wing talk radio all day. It's like, to know what the other side is up to. It's like, no, you just admit you're entertained by Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, just admit you like it. You sit there crazy. And you get entertained by it.
Funny is how right-wing his ex-wife became, Exene.
Oh.
Yeah, she was like, oh, I'm moving to Texas because we can carry guns. And she was getting into all this Alex Jones type stuff. She was like, she turned out to be like a real libertarian.
Is this Exene from X?
X, yes. Viggo Mortensen was married to her.
Are you serious? I didn't know that.
They have a son. Or they had a son from that marriage.
Huh.
In the 80s, they were married. She didn't marry John Doe in the 80s. She married Viggo Mortensen.
Weird. I didn't know that.
Yeah. You wouldn't think. He's like, Viggo, he'd get Miss America if he wanted to.
No, of course.
Yeah, they always bury these women that's like, okay, you know, and I think she was older than him,
too. He could have weird sex with Maria Bello, who's lesbian, that no couple ever has.
Yes.
Where they 69 each other in her cheerleader outfit.
Yeah, because that's what all couples do.
Of course.
We never got to know each other as cheerleaders, as teenagers. I'm going to fix that.
Yeah, who the hell wrote that?
I don't know, John, but you know,
up the Damned. When I saw the Damned live in 2001, or I think it was 2001, I became a huge fan.
Yeah,
I finally saw them live, and I got it live. Like, and then I saw them when the Misfits did their first Fiendfest tour. The Damned blew every other band off the stage.
I'll bet they did.
They were incredible, and I was just like, okay, I totally get it now. And like, I totally got Dave Vanian's like frontman presence and stuff. It's like, no, I totally, this band rules.
Yeah,
you know, it's like they're better live than they are on record. That's just the truth. It's like,
no, they're live. There's a reason they put out like 100 live records. It's because their live albums are fucking awesome.
Yeah,
like totally. I listen to their live records more than the studio ones.
Like, definitely,
they're like, for the Blackout. It's you know, produced by Hans Zimmer. It's fine, but then you listen to the live version, it's like, you know, you want to kick the walls down. You know, it's awesome.
Right. They're live. They just kill. And then if you listen to their studio stuff, it's kind of like, it's just not the same. They have more energy. They have better energy live. I always recommend seeing The Damned, even currently. And they're all old as hell. But
yeah,
I'd still say go see them.
But speaking of live music, John.
Yes.
We're here today to talk about a movie about live music.
Yeah.
Or kind of. It's about country music.
Yes.
We're here to talk about an American classic, or at least I called it a classic today at work, the movie Nashville, directed by Robert Altman.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to a guy at work, and he goes, so what are you doing tonight? And I go, I'm going to do a podcast. And he goes, about what? He always, you know, wants to elaborate. And I go, about the movie Nashville, a classic film by Robert Altman. And he goes, it's not a classic. And I go, no, it's, you know, well-liked movie. And he goes, I haven't heard of it.
No.
And I go, no, that's probably true. It's kind of, you know, I guess it's a little cold. And he's like, and he starts pointing out like coworkers near us. He goes, ask her if she's seen it. And he starts like going around like, have you seen Nashville? Nope. He's like, see, nobody's seen it.
Yeah, but I always wonder, among your peers, what's considered a classic?
I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, I think, but, you know, Nashville, like, I can count on a couple fingers the friends I know who've seen it.
Yeah.
But
well, then again, Laura is a classic. Can you count on your fingers how many people have seen Laura?
Yes, I know, like, two people who have seen it.
Right. Even the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah.
You're not going to find a lot of people who've seen it.
Like, when I say it's a classic, I just mean it's been written about a lot by connoisseurs.
Yeah, well, it is a classic with people who actually watch old movies.
Funnily enough, I saw a BBC poll today, the BBC, which gets relentlessly made fun of in this movie. And it was like asking, like, they did a poll of filmmakers what the best movies are, and Nashville was one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things where, like, when you're young and you're getting into film, if you're in my generation,
yeah,
you see the films of Paul Thomas Anderson, and you go, oh, this Paul Thomas Anderson fellow knows how to weave a fabric of many stories. Right. And then you find out Paul Thomas Anderson is a big fan of Robert Altman. And then you watch Robert Altman movies and you go, oh, Paul Thomas Anderson. Never mind!
You know? Yeah, he was basically, he spent his career ripping off Robert Altman.
Like, Nashville is one of those movies that gets better and better every time I see it.
Yeah.
And Altman, but Altman specialized, like, you watch movies like Magnolia from PTA or from Paul Thomas Anderson, and you watch, you know, that stuff he does. And then you watch Nashville, you watch Shortcuts, you watch these sort of, Altman doing those sorts of movies, and you go, this is much better.
Right.
And so you saw Nashville recently because James yes. Ellroy did a screening of it, your new bromance.
Yeah, my sober drinking buddy, James Ellroy. Sure.
Yes. And he did one. And when you, and I was kind of surprised because I always thought of Nashville as kind of a lefty movie, but I saw different dimensions to it this time. Mm-hmm. But you said something very, you said that he was screening it. And when he said why, I was very interested because he said it's a movie where everyone talks differently. It's a movie where all the characters are characters. They all have their own way of speaking. And I thought right. that was very interesting because I was like, you know, because he said in all movies today, people talk the same. Like, you, yeah. you watch mainstream movies, they all have the same Joss Whedon-y, James Gunn-y yeah. dialogue, you know.
Well, he said in crime films, all crime films, they have to be The Wire. Because I asked him, I go, why is your stuff always rewritten? You write an original script, Rampart, Street Kings, and I said, why do they always have somebody rewrite your script if you're this beloved writer? And he goes, because he's like, studio executives want The Wire. That's what they know on television. That's what they see. They want it to be like The Wire, where everybody's talking real cool and hip.
Yeah, it's hip. It's
yeah, and it's just and he says so. He doesn't write his screenplays like that. He writes his screenplays with the idea everybody's speaking differently.
Yeah,
and everybody has different speech patterns, vocal tones, everything. It's in his scripts, and he says that's not what the executives want. They want what they see on television. Well, The Wire is the cop show, so it needs to be like The Wire.
One second. Shut up! Okay, keep going.
You're like the boys from Brazil there. You're like the Adolf Hitler kid.
Oh, god damn. Dog's losing her shit.
But, you know, like, Elroy hates Quentin Tarantino. He despises
well,
Quentin
and he's another symptom of that. It's that Tarantino was kind of the guy who ushered in that super hip, cool, like, everybody talks the same dialogue.
Yeah, he said that Quentin Tarantino, he goes, Tarantino's movies are basically white guys and black guys talking about their guns, talking about their sweet rides and their badass bitches. He goes, I spent a lot of time in jail, not prison, but in L.A. County jail for various offenses in the late 60s and early 70s, and I heard infinitely better dialogue from my cellmates, black, white, Hispanic, Oriental, and he's like also talking about their badass bitches, their sweet rides, and their guns. It's this is like, yeah, he says Tarantino's like a poser. It's just stuff stolen, you know. It's not the way anybody speaks, and it's like he doesn't like his work at all, and he doesn't like gratuitous violence. That's a funny thing about Elroy. He says things are too vulgar and violent in movies today.
He's likes. Right.
It's what he enjoys about early the Hitchcock movies he likes. He also introduced Vertigo a few months ago as part of his program. And he was just like, you know, he likes the suggestion. He thinks movies are too vulgar now. And it's just like the suggestion of Hitchcock. He thinks it's a lot stronger when you leave things to the imagination. I'm paraphrasing. This whole time I'm paraphrasing him.
These well, but I mean, but that's totally true. Like, one thing I love about, like, I remember for ages, people told me that The Birds was minor Hitchcock. Ah, you don't need to see that. But I remember watching it and thinking it was terrifyingly apocalyptic. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a movie where birds are attacking people. On paper, sounds kind of dumb. When you watch the movie, it feels like the world's ending.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like
I always got the, I saw it a bunch of times when I was a kid. It's like the only Hitchcock movie aired on WTBS in 1980. So it was on constantly. So I saw it multiple times. And I was, it always felt like an end of the world movie.
Yeah. It feels like, you know, you're, it's a very micro version of a macro event.
Right. And it's written by Ed McBain, who Evan Hunter, who wrote all the 87th Precinct novels, which one of which inspired High and Low, the great Kurosawa film.
Oh, yeah.
Which Elroy also introduced at a big screening last year.
Of course. That seems like something he would like.
I got to talk to him about Ed McBain next time. But one thing I noticed, like, we were trying to figure out also why he was showing it. And after the movie was over, we talked to him afterwards, and I said, it's because of the parallel storylines. That's why you like it. And he went, exactly.
Yeah.
Because if you read his novels, it's four or five stories going on at the same time. L.A. Confidential, the movie,
is just one of them. It's just like,
is an adaptation, seriously, of about 25% of the novel.
Yeah, it's just...
And it's not even accurate. It's not even that faithful. They had to do that for a two-hour movie, but it's 25% of the novel at best. And that's why he likes Nashville, because that's inspired him to write these big, sprawling crime novels with all different things going on at the same time, because nobody else is really doing that.
Yeah, because like the plot of Nashville is pretty hard to sum up, because it's so many different stories and so many different little plots.
It's like a day in the life, or it's a week in the life in Nashville. Like really is no driving story.
Like, it's basically, you have this day in Nashville, there's a political candidate, Hal mm-hmm. Philip Walker, who's, you know, creating waves. You have this diva in town, Barbara Jean.
Yeah.
Who's had health problems, and she's fucking crazy. Like, played by
Ronnie
Blakely.
I was trying to figure out, like, obviously she was inspired by Loretta Lynn, but I've never heard of Loretta Lynn being this kind of strange person with health problems. So I don't know if that was based on somebody else at the time.
And it kind of feels like you're getting this Nashville celebrity culture.
Yeah,
and you have that on one end, and then you have sort of these minor musicians, and then you also have these people who haven't made it who want to make it.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have these groupies. Once, like, there's the groupie played by Shelley Duvall,
right?
Who dresses in the kind of clothes you see girls wearing now. you have like these that girl who hasn't made it, who wants to make it, and at the very end she sings.
Yeah.
You have these weirdos, Jeff Goldblum's biker, who rides like he's an easy rider, but it's like a three-wheeler, so...
And never has a word of dialogue through the whole film.
No, he doesn't say anything.
Isn't that something? And that had to be his first big role, because that was after the Death Wish mugger role.
Well, was this... I think it was... Yeah, it was before... It was before... No, never mind. I'm confusing that with something else. No, yeah, I think it was his first big role. And it was when Jeff Goldblum could ride a motorcycle and not seem completely insane.
Right, right. He's just doing magic tricks.
But you have, like, politicians, you have musicians, you have managers.
Yeah.
And,
Journalists.
Journalists.
You have Elliot Gould!
You have Elliot Gould playing himself wearing a fucking ridiculous, like, dashiki or something. And I was kind of thinking, like, that's like Hollywood taking the piss a little bit. It's Elliot Gould, like, being a, you know, a goofy celebrity.
Yeah.
But, one character I loved was the girl from the BBC.
Yeah.
Who's making her documentary. And right. That is a character you would never see in a movie today, because it so relentlessly makes fun of a foreign character.
Oh, yeah. She's a complete idiot.
She's a fucking moron. And yeah. She's wandering through that junkyard. I see the corpses of the cars. Are you calling to me, cars? Hello? Hello? All these buses are yellow. How many little black children and little white children went to school on these buses? No, it
yeah,
needs to be
it,
more
it
positive.
Was a riot.
No,
I was
more
laughing
negative.
My ass off.
Yellow that is the stuff. Color of cowardice. Yellow is the color of sunshine. But the little black children and the little white children only saw gray on these school buses.
Yeah, it's that's one of the best characters in the movie.
She's so hilarious. I mean, I was like, you would never see that in an American film today. It would just be totally irreverent.
Not at all, because they always act like, oh, they're the you know, we're an inferior country.
Oh, if anything, it's like, oh, the BBC's real news.
They're brilliant because they're far left.
Yeah, they're the real news, you guys.
And they hate Israel with a passion, so they're the real thing.
But in this movie, she's a fucking, like, the BBC reporter's this goofy broad.
Yeah, it's actually, that's one of the reasons I thought the film, like, Elroy was saying, he said the movie loves America, yet criticizes it at the same time.
It does.
But I was like, it does love America. It's a very, actually surprisingly, patriotic film.
Yeah, like, I was kind of watching it, and I was thinking, it's a left movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, when I was you know, in college, I thought of Robert Altman as, like, this old leftist. You know, this old Democrat, you know, whenever you see interviews with him, he's just talking about, oh, I hate the Republicans and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to do Prairie Home Companion with Garrison Keillor. But I watched this movie and I'm like, oh, this was back when the left actually liked America. This was before the Frankfurt School took it over.
Yeah, you know? Was a time when they were actually patriotic.
Yeah. Like, I mean, like, that's it. There was some funny stuff that kind of felt like taking the piss out of a little bit, like where that woman was talking about, you know, why they wouldn't vote for Kennedy, Tennessee went for the asshole, was anti-Catholicism. They can't vote for the Catholic because he's a good man.
Yeah, it couldn't be because the Catholic probably wanted more overreaching government, yeah, which Southerners don't really go for.
Exactly.
You know, nobody likes the mayor in a southern town. So
exactly,
it's usually the guy who runs the funeral home.
And you know, it is a pretty. It does have like that leftist cynicism.
Yeah,
in it, like it opens with Henry Gibson's. He plays a famous singer named Haven Hamilton, who's sort of he dresses like a much older Elvis, but that was kind of how country stars dressed.
Well, he like dresses like Webb Pierce.
Webb Pierce, okay, because I was going to say, like
he's wearing one of those, like, new, he's based on a performer, and I'm sure I could look it up on IMDb. It wasn't somebody I listened to.
Yeah,
somebody.
I mean, I know he's not based on Elvis, but I was kind of like, that was my closest reference that I could come
right,
up with.
Right, he's the type of country singer that had been around a while and had become a very successful businessman as well, like a Porter Wagoner or a Webb Pierce or Jimmy Dean or one of those guys. It's like they in Nashville, those guys were really established and were kind of all over the place and hands in politics and everything else. So it kind of made, like, his character rang true. Like, there's guys like
well,
that.
Well, and the movie opens with him singing this patriotic song.
Yeah.
And it's like because this is like the bicentennial, basically. It's like, this movie came out in 75. It's right before 1976.
Yeah.
So they're singing this patriotic song, like, about the next 100 years and all that. And it juxtaposes him, like, yelling, constantly stopping to yell at the piano player Frog. He keeps stopping to yell at him and tell, you know, I need a piano player. I need the one I asked for. And then it juxtaposes that with, like, the black choir just, like, rocking out and singing.
Right.
And they're just singing with abandon and having fun. And he keeps stopping the recording to yell at them. And it sort of, it felt very, but it was pretty funny.
Yeah.
But I was like, I wrote down on my notes that I thought it felt pretty cynical. But, and I love that the opening credits kind of feel like an old compilation record commercial.
Yeah.
Like that you see on TV.
A lot of, I'm young or old enough to remember those ads. So,
like, I remember
the 90s really
versions of those, like, now that's what I call music, featuring
in the 70s, it was KTEL Presents Country Classics or KTEL Presents. They actually advertised one that had garage rock, but they called it something else, like psychedelic hits or sunny 60s hits, but it was all question mark of the Mysterians and Paul Revere and the Raiders. Just great stuff. I wish I'd ordered that when I was that young, but yeah, I remember those ads. Like, I was cracking up. Even the announcer sounded like the KTEL announcer.
Yeah. I thought that was a really clever way to open the movie. But you know, but getting back to, like, you know, do you think it was kind of referencing, like, because the movie feels like it's kind of referencing the movement at the time, man. but kind of making fun of it a little bit.
Oh yeah.
Like it has like a lot of the Easy Rider reference with the motorcycles and like all the hippies, but all the hippies feel like idiots.
Well, here's the funny thing. Beatniks hated hippies.
Ah.
I don't know where Robert Altman fell in that.
Well, he's older than all those guys. Like he was a
fighter pilot in World War II.
Yeah, like he'd been directing TV for a long time before he
flew bombing missions. He directed like a bunch of episodes of Combat and a bunch of stuff. He wasn't. I don't know if he probably thought the hippies were idiots. I know that Jack Kerouac hated hippies.
Oh yeah, Jack Kerouac was a Catholic.
Yeah, he did. And I found out Bob Dylan didn't even like hippies.
No, you know.
Because they never left him alone. He was annoyed by them. It's like he didn't want to be some messiah.
Why do you
think
he went evangelistic Christian, you know, just to alienate them?
why do you think he said Barry Goldwater was his favorite politician?
Yeah, Barry Goldwater, you know, he spoke a lot of truth.
And then on his Dylan radio hour that was on satellite radio forever, he said Richard Nixon is our most misunderstood and underrated president.
You know, I think Richard Nixon pretty misunderstood. You know,
yeah. Well, he'd be interviewed by Rolling Stone. They're like, "How come you haven't performed? You know, you haven't written an anti-war song or an anti-Vietnam song?" He goes, "How do you know I'm not full of Vietnam War?" he made fun of Jan Winter in his one of his recent interviews about global warming. He's like, "Global what?" He goes, "Global warming." He's like, "What are you talking about? It's freezing up here." Just interviewing him on like his farm.
Which if you want to make somebody from Rolling Stone go ballistic, if you say global warming, go, "It's colder than it's ever been." And they go,
it's climate change. But also, Dylan wouldn't say anything bad about George Bush, which, you know, Rolling Stone was just, "We hate George Bush every month."
Oh, it was every episode. It was like, it's like, "Worst president ever." We get a historian to tell us why
and
he's
Dylan,
the worst. And I'm like,
Dylan would say nothing bad about him.
Yeah,
he refused to.
I remember that.
It's and I mean, he likes Obama too, but I think he was pretty much just a middle of the road.
Oh sure.
You know, politically, he just didn't. Who knows if he even votes? You know, it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, probably talks a lot about politics, doesn't even vote. You know,
and
there's plenty of them.
And I feel like political assassinations were a big thing in the '70s in movies, like Taxi Driver. Right.
Well, because of RFK. Yeah. I think it wasn't just JFK, but
no,
I think the RFK.
No, RFK came later. So.
Plus, the whole Jack Ruby killing Oswald and the RFK thing. And then there may have been even other assassinations at the time.
Well, okay.
Think, you know.
Martin Luther King was one.
Yeah, Martin Luther King.
Malcolm
X.
Yeah.
Killed by Nation of Islam guys. Which
although they don't mention that when they talk about
Farrakhan
it.
Ordered that hit. Everybody knows
of course,
it.
Of course. He'll tell you it was the Jews. Right,
because you know, so do all the French who were all the Parisians.
If you ask, I love that video of Gavin McInnes going around France. So who shot up the Bataclan? It was the Jews.
Yeah, France doesn't get a lot of sympathy from me. I hate to say, I like a lot of things about their culture. Man, I have no sympathy.
So tangent, but like this is a movie. Nashville, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, but I won't spoil too much. There's a shooting at a concert in the movie, and you can feel it coming. Like, there's a lot of talk about assassinations. One of my favorite bits is when the BBC reporter goes, "You know, I feel like when the reason there's assassinations in this country, it's because the people who own guns send a subliminal message to the people who are innocent otherwise, but they get the idea. And then they go and kill people." The thing is, in the movie, it's presented as a fucking retarded argument, but now that's presented as a totally valid argument in today's press.
Oh, yeah, and it's hilarious.
But so, today in the news, recently in the news, speaking of Gavin McInnes,
right,
did an interview with Jesse Hughes from the Eagles of Death Metal. Mm-hmm. And Jesse Hughes was, you know, saying, you know, I think the Bataclan security was in on it, because being a guy who's played a few concerts in his life, probably is aware of what protocol is. Noticed a lot of strange people walking around.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever, you know, worked a concert, you know, like, tickets aren't something you just give away. They're pretty stingy about those. and like backstage passes and all that. And so he's seen a lot of people, and so he said he thought security was in on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the dog whistle, as they say there, is that security probably a Middle Eastern gentleman, maybe.
Yeah.
Right. But. And he also said he saw Muslims dancing in the streets, and he also said that French gun control laws have made people, you know, too accepting of death.
Yes.
Like, if people show up with guns, they go, that's it. He said he saw these people getting shot, and, you know, people would take time to reload, and the people would just stand there.
Jesus.
You know, and, and you know, Jesse, of course, has he has bits of a stranger skull embedded in his face from when a dude's head exploded.
Right.
But all these websites are like, Jesse Hughes is a racist bigot, and they're calling him all these names. And I'm sitting here thinking, didn't this guy just survive a horrible terrorist attack? Why are we citing? Why are we siding with his with the people who murdered 90 people over him?
Yeah, they're because these websites, Metal Hammer, Metal Sucks, whatever.
Metal Sucks.
You know, I shouldn't even give them publicity, but it's like they're basically the online version of spitting on vets coming back from the war.
They really are.
That's all it is.
And it's like you know, Metal Hammer, their editor was the one who wrote that that ridiculous article in The Guardian about how the Mastodon the Motherlode video was misogynist because it had black girls twerking.
Jesus Christ.
And it was like, this is misogynist and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, didn't I see you on a live DVD of a concert where you were dragging a woman in leather on all fours around and you were wearing black metal makeup?
Yeah.
I mean, this was the same guy. He did a guest spot at a concert where he did that during a show. And I'm like, so you're calling you're calling Mastodon misogynist, and you did that at a show. Is that how this works?
But it's ridiculous. It's like, you know, it's like, what do a lot of these wimps don't realize? Yeah, ovaries do dry up when you start talking like that.
It's true.
Yeah.
I always go like, this is,
yeah, I know Gavin brings that up a lot on his show, but he's right. He goes, these feminist men, they're not turning any women on.
No
woman is saying that they want to fuck Joss Whedon.
No, I mean, and, you know, even the comic book girls you see that love Joss Whedon, they've got these, like, boyfriends who, like, you know, are in the military or something.
They want the jocks with the testosterone. They don't want the weak-chinned comic book geek.
Hey, I don't see what's so what was it? Gavin said that good pranks to pull on your friends on Facebook. Log in on their account and just say on their status update, I don't see what's so funny about being a male feminist. But no, it's true. It's one of those things where I know a lot of girls who beat that drum, but they're with guys who do manly stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Like Dante Nero.
Yes. But, yeah, I guess we shouldn't talk about too much stuff that's behind a paywall. But,
yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, no, nobody knows what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But especially our global fans.
You can listen to the free speech podcast.
We're going to have none in France after this, if we have any.
Right.
But,
but no, that really was grinding my gears today. Like, I felt like it was Western civilization, you know.
Well, that's the type of stuff I witnessed. After 9/11, I witnessed that type of stuff. They give the Muslims whatever they want, or, just so this doesn't happen. It's just wussy shit. Don't overreact in anger.
It's one of those things where it's like, nobody in history who's ever gone, we're so sorry, what did we ever do to you, we'll fix it, has ever come out winning. And when I say winning, I don't mean just like, hey, we win, we're the best. I mean, like, surviving.
Right.
You know? Like getting rights and freedoms and just to live your life.
Well, Dan Inosanto, the man who taught Bruce Lee how to do the nunchaku and worked with the Filipino fighting sticks, I attended a training seminar he did, and he said that no culture has survived without a strong military element.
It's true.
It just doesn't. If it doesn't have that, they won't survive. And, you know, he's a big student of history, reader of history.
They also don't survive without borders. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway. Yeah, the whole Bataclan thing's disgusting. Yeah, oh, hate fact. We'll do a hate fact podcast. But we'll get kicked off of iTunes in no time. Eagles of Death Metal, I love them as a band.
I love them, yeah. Great band. I mean,
only group I probably buy every CD and love, and you know, just a fun band.
Zipper Down was one of my favorite records of last year by far.
Yeah, it's terrific. And it's unfortunate they've now become the most important band in the world.
I think so.
And I don't think anybody else has realized it, but they are. They're the most important band in the world. And unfortunately, with the way these music industry pussies are treating them, they're going to be devoted to basically doing shows with Ted Nugent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think Jesse's worldview, aside from the weed and, you know, all that, is more in line with Ted's than it is with, you know, the establishment.
Well, he's a Republican Catholic.
Yeah, and I heard he used to be a GOP speechwriter.
He might have been.
Yeah.
I wouldn't doubt it.
And I know Josh Homme he's kind of quiet about it, but he's also pretty right. And Palm Desert, where, you know, those guys from Eagles of Death Metal and Queens of the Stone Age and Caius and all those bands are from, is a very Republican part of California.
Yeah, they do exist.
Yeah. That's kind of considered a Republican enclave. And Jesse Hughes and Josh Homme both have kind of reputations for being a right of center, but you don't see – Jesse talks about it a lot more than Josh does.
Yeah, he's more open about it. Well, his band can take the risk because they're not huge.
Yeah.
Although they probably will be now. I got to see if I can get a ticket for their July show if it isn't already sold out.
Yeah, they just played in here, but it was a weeknight and, you know.
God, I'm sure they'll be packed. I mean,
they were at House of Blues.
They're that kind of band now.
Yeah, and you know, and God bless them for continuing to play after what happened to them. Because yeah. I was kind of wondering, because he's a pretty eccentric guy. I was kind of wondering if he was gonna fall apart after what happened. But he kind of seems galvanized by it.
Yeah, it's just they're more important than ever, and you know, fuck anybody that's not booking them.
Yeah, I agree.
It's
so
ridiculous.
Fuck those French festivals that dropped them. They suck.
Yeah. The hell with them.
But anyway, but so Nashville is a movie that has a shooting in it. And it, yeah. This is not Dallas. This is Nashville.
Yeah.
But, and they sing a song afterwards. And it kind of feels, even through the movie's cynicism, it feels a little optimistic. Sorry, I had somewhere I was going and I lost my spot in my notes.
You anyway, take notes?
I did for this, just because...
Okay, Poindexter.
I know.
We're about tangents.
I'm sorry, I'm not autistic like you, John.
Sir, please.
But, you know, we talked about some of the Altman movies we like. You like The Player, right?
I don't care for The Player.
Oh, I thought you liked it.
No. I said Ford Fairlane's a better movie about Hollywood.
Okay. What are some other Altman movies you like?
I like I like The Long Goodbye.
That's a great movie. Yeah.
And
it's a lot like this one too. Like it's a movie with a lot of weirdos. But it has a more singular storyline. But
yes.
It has like you have like Arnold Schwarzenegger in the background. You know.
Yeah,
like,
it's his first movie role after Hercules Goes Bananas.
And it has a lot of like LA, it's like, you know, Philip Marlowe in a sea of LA weirdness. Like,
yes.
But in this movie has a lot of that weirdness, but you know, Long Goodbye is more focused on one character. This movie is just all over the place. It's like a tapestry. It's like a quilt. You know?
Yes. Now, Elroy liked The Long Goodbye. He said the only other film he liked was McCabe and Mrs. Miller,
which
but
is a great movie. Great movie.
And then I said, which I have not seen, and then I said, well, what about The Long Goodbye? He goes, oh, yeah, The Long Goodbye, you know? And it's like, and then he started telling me all these details about The Long Goodbye after he explained all of McCabe and Mrs. Miller giving the movie away to me, and I haven't seen it. I think he's going to try to get it to screen. I'll have to remind him that Criterion's putting it out, and they could probably score that.
Yeah, yeah, remind him of that, because McCabe and Mrs. Miller is probably my favorite Altman movie.
Yeah, he said that's also the only Warren Beatty movie he likes.
I believe I it might be the only Warren Beatty movie I like too.
Other you know, oh, you don't like Bullworth? Come on.
No. But, he's a liberal politician who has nothing to lose.
You know, Trump really is kinda like Bullworth.
He kind of is.
Shit.
Oh my God.
It's a frightening thought.
Another movie of Altman's I like is Shortcuts. I don't think it's as successful as Nashville, but it's one that kind of has that Tapestry feeling.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
I know Stu really likes it because Julianne Moore has an extended scene with no pants on.
Right.
But, but, you know, I saw Prairie Home Companion, didn't really care for it. Couldn't get through MASH.
Really?
Yeah.
Everybody always tells me that one's good. I've never seen it.
Nah, I didn't care for it. Maybe if I try it again, I'll like it. But I remember...
I don't like Popeye. I've seen Popeye.
Oh, I've seen Popeye. Yeah, that one's...
It has its fans.
It has very good production values. I'll say that.
Yeah, that's all you can give it.
But this movie, I remember you saying when we were talking about doing it, you said it was a real American movie.
Yeah, it is.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you couldn't make it in any other country.
It feels unique to this culture.
Yes, it's regional.
Yeah,
it's about that city in Tennessee. Can you name any other film made in Nashville in the last 30 something years? It's tough.
I can, but that's because I used to.
Three or four, maybe.
Well, it's because I used to work in the Tennessee film industry, but they're not ones that you would think of and you would go, oh, well, that was made in Nashville.
And also call attention to the fact it's Nashville. And, I took a vacation in Nashville years ago alone, because I was not married at the time or even dating, and went to Nashville and just hung out there for a week. Loved it. And a lot of people put that city down and claim Memphis is better or whatever, I guess, because
they're
not
totally different.
They're totally different cities. But
it's stupid to even compare them.
Yeah, they're not even they're not comparable at all. They're completely different cities. And Nashville, I thought, was really nice. I liked it. It's just like I was actually looking into trying to move there and, you know, transfer my job to that state. And just so I could be near Nashville and be near the town where they bottle Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
And
bottle Jack Daniels and country music.
Exactly. It's like, that's what I wanted. It's like, you know, I wasn't crazy about living in Colorado with the long ass winters, and it's still a problem I have with it. But and I miss the South because people are so polite down there.
Oh, people, so, even in Texas, like, people call Texas the South. I'm like, no, people aren't as nice here as they are.
No, people, when you're in Tennessee, see, people are super nice. It's noticeable.
In Memphis, I could go to a bar and make friends.
Yes.
I can't do that here.
No.
I go to a bar, I talk to people, and they seem bothered.
Right. They're there to drink and die.
they're there to drink, or they're there to, like, hang out with their friends, you know.
Right.
And like, they want to be with whoever they came with. They don't want to talk to you. I mean, it's there are exceptions to that rule. I have made some friends going out. But those people are not the rule. They're weirdos.
Like, no, in Tennessee, it was just nice. Girls were nice. You know, it's like they're talkative and friendly. Everybody's friendly.
Well, that's why they say the best American writers came from the South, because they like to talk to strangers.
And they also can pick up on all sorts of conversations, because they'll talk. You know, you can talk to anybody.
Yeah,
and it's just. It's different,
and I've noticed too. Like, when people would talk to you in the South, usually they were just wanting to talk. They just wanted to talk. Here in Texas and a lot of other places I've been, if a stranger comes to talk to you, they're trying to hustle you.
Yes,
you know, they want something. They're trying to fuck with you. Yeah. And I've noticed, and you know, living in Memphis, you know, I kind of got used to people just wanting to chit chat, and then I come to other places and I talk to people, and then I quickly realize, oh shit, this person's trying to run a game on me. And you know, it was one of those things that I had to get used to, was, okay, people, you know, have an ulterior motive. And that's one reason I think people are fucking assholes when you try to talk to them here.
Yes, it's true. And it's not much different in Colorado.
Yeah, I think that's most places. It's not just Texas. I went to Philadelphia recently, and anybody who came, like, there was one dude who came up to chit chat, who was nice, and everybody else was trying to fucking, like, scam us. You know, who was a stranger who would talk to me and my dad.
Right. And but it's definitely true in Chicago. Holy hell. That's where I saw pickpockets working the streets for the first time.
Oh, God.
Trying to shake everybody's hand and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, this guy came up to us in Philadelphia and was like, hey, hello, sir. Comes up, reaches his hand out, and we're just like, fuck off. You know?
Right. You have to be. It's the way it is. But no, it's like people are genuinely nice. And it doesn't look like Nashville looked about the same.
Yeah, it had the big Parthenon. Like, there's the big concert at the Parthenon.
Yeah.
At the end, like the big Greek replica.
Yes, yes. And that was the new Opry. That wasn't the old Opry that's in the Ryman Theater. They actually had it at the Opryland, even I think it's 75. And it's like, I just know that. I know that theater, you know, because I went to a Grand Ole Opry broadcast because, you know, they do the shows twice a week. And it's just everything about that film. It's so real American. The funny thing is, supposedly, on the online trivia, it was not a popular film in Nashville.
Well, and when you watch the Criterion Blu-ray,
mm-hmm.
They have the interviews with, they have the making of and all that. They had some people talking about, like, was Robert Altman making fun of Southern culture? And a lot of the people making the movie said, no, I don't think he was. I think it was an homage. I think there are elements that are definitely making fun of country music culture. Like,
yeah.
You know, the people who want to be famous, who have no fucking talent, like that stripper girl who
right.
can't sing. And there's, you know, the groupies and all that. And you know, and I think the Haven character that Henry Gibson plays is, you know, there's a little bit of a criticism of him.
Well, I also picked up that Keith Carradine's character may have been based on Kris Kristofferson.
Oh, that's a good, that's an interesting observation.
Because he had a rep for just basically banging anything.
Yeah, because the Keith Carradine character, he's, you know, he's having affairs with women and just, you know, kind of just treating them like shit.
Yeah, and it's like, I wonder if that was based on Kristofferson, because it seems to ring true. And, you know, and, Christina Raines, who looks great in this, I thought might have been Linda Ronstadt. And, you know, who did not have a group with Kristofferson, but they kind of do the whole, you know, he was part of a band that broke up.
Yeah.
Which I guess you could almost.
Which was over a woman, you know.
Right, right. Which maybe it's Graham Parsons. I don't know. But I think it's really Kris Kristofferson. I think that's who he's based on. Or he's probably, every character is really like a combination of different performers.
Sure.
Like, it's the, like the Ronnie Blakely singer is obviously based on Loretta Lynn.
Yeah.
I think they said that much. She may also be based on, I think Dottie West had problems with pills and stuff. I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and look in old books.
She reminds me of every girl I've ever known who's had problems. Like, every girl I have ever known who has a problem with the prescription pills acts like her.
Right, you know? Right. They all
but
do.
But not as talented.
There's also there's a hypochondriac element to him as well.
Oh, of course.
Which I think they were hinting at. And Alan Garfield, I thought, was hilarious as her husband.
Yeah. But there was also, like, a really sincere element with the Shelley Duvall's uncle.
Yeah.
Who has the wife dying in
Keenan Wynn.
Keenan Wynn, yeah.
That is the most heartbreaking performance in the film.
Yeah,
it's
this really sad part of the movie because it's this guy who's got his wife in the hospital and you have this circus surrounding him and this guy and it's like you have a celebrity and obsession and like all this superficial shit and then there's this guy whose wife is dying and even the military guy who he kind of bonds with when his wife dies, comes up to him and is like, oh, I'm going to go see Barbara Jean. Hey, give your wife my best, you know. Like, nobody really gives a shit about
right.
about like Shelley Duvall comes in and he's like, oh, you got to come see your aunt. And she's just like, oh, whatever. You know, she just wants to chase whatever singer she's after.
Right, you know? Right. She's basically chasing dick. For
yeah, the whole time she even shacks up with the assassin.
Yes.
She, like, tries to open his fiddle. He's like, don't open that. And it turns out there's a gun in there.
And then they just pretty much, you can tell by the next scene, they've obviously screwing. And but, yeah, the Keenan Wynn, who usually plays a gruff authority character.
Yeah, usually when I think of Keenan Wynn, I think of, like, Point Blank.
Well, like, I think of Kolchak the Night Stalker, where he was a police commissioner. He's like, Kolchak, there's no werewolves in the sewer, or whatever the hell he would say. You know, and here he is. He's just this guy absolutely crushed by life.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where you have, like, a normal dude in the midst of all this superficial stuff. And
yeah.
It's this real tragedy that's taking place that's completely ignored by everybody because they all care about Barbara Jean and they all care about Haven, you know, and all that.
Right. Yeah, it's phenomenal. Like, there's some bad acting in the film because a lot of it's improvised.
Oh, yeah. Altman's movies are very, like, people talking over each other.
Yeah.
Like, some scenes, you kind of watch it, and there's some moments where you're like, what just happened there? I don't know.
Yeah.
But some of it's really, like, brief and funny. Like, it's one of those movies that gets better each time you watch it because you notice more things.
Right.
There's more little interactions you go, oh, that's really funny, or, oh, that adds to that story. I didn't see that before. Because it's just one of those movies that's so dense. You know?
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
All at once. And, I mean, there's stuff that's never really even explained. Like, the Scott Glenn military character is never really explained.
No, yeah. He's just... I don't even know why he's there. But he has some good interactions here and there. But there's some characters. Like, the Jeff Goldblum character. What's he doing there? I don't know.
Nothing.
He just does magic tricks and rides a motorcycle.
Yeah. He serves no purpose whatsoever. It's there's a lot of odd little things like that. But, you know, they don't really make movies like this anymore. Now that Altman's dead, certainly.
They don't. But, and it has, like, all these great little, like, I love the Hal Philip Walker truck that goes around, like, espousing political sermons.
Yeah, which, boy, Richard Linklater has ripped that off.
Oh, for, big time.
Yeah, for that Waking Life or whatever.
And Slacker a little bit, too.
Yeah. It's like, well, he had Alex Jones in Waking Life.
Yeah, he did. Alex Jones was in Waking Life. And he even
had
a stark red face, too.
Yeah. And the early Alex Jones, like, long before he was well known. it's just, noticing the stuff that other filmmakers have ripped off and the Linklater influence is really blatant.
I love some of the sermons. Like, he's like 95% of politicians are lawyers. If you want to change American politics, is this representative of the population?
It's funny because by today's standards, I don't think people would look at this as a liberal film.
No, and in fact, I don't think it's a liberal film by the
No,
way
I don't,
we,
I don't think it's political, really.
I don't think it is either, and I don't think it's like, you could call it sort of a weird, like, you know, Pauline Kael was a real force behind this movie. Like, she really pushed it.
Yeah.
And I think at the time, people would have seen it as a liberal movie, and maybe that's why it didn't pick up in Nashville. And, like, when you said it would have hit in Nashville, I was thinking maybe people in Nashville thought it was making fun of them. Because that was a question that was brought up on the Criterion thing. And also it could be because that's a more right-leaning part of the country and they may have seen it as sort of a hippie movie.
Yeah.
But when I watch it today, I'm like, this is actually a movie that has a strong love of America. And it seems to make fun of the modern version of liberals that we have, like the BBC interviewer character. Like, she very, like, a lot of the stuff she says in the movie is are the things you hear from the left today that get made fun of in this movie.
Exactly. Yeah, back then they made fun of that, and then nowadays they take it seriously.
Like, she's like, the guns, when people see the guns, innocent people see them, and then they want to go and kill. You hear that said with a straight face today. And in the movie,
it's presented
as, like, a retarded opinion.
Yeah, because it is. And that's the thing, is retarded left-wing opinions are now mainstream.
Yeah. And, like,
and they're not even laughed at. We used to mock that stuff.
Exactly.
Years ago. If you watch the first season of In Living Color, Jim Carrey is playing a really annoying environmentalist.
And now he is that person.
Yes, that's really him now. But back then, boy, they were mocking that to death, like, just shaming it. And now, no, that's mainstream. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's really insane.
And but it's a movie that, like, it ends on this sort of patriotic note.
Yeah.
I mean, it has the assassination and the, you know, it's something that seems like it's out of Taxi Driver, which is a really cynical movie. But and this movie has kind of seemingly cynical elements, but in the end, it feels like a pretty a movie that kind of is like, yeah, this is sort of a flawed country, but you know, we have a great culture, we have a great people, and, you know, and all that. So
right.
But no, this is a movie that grows in my estimation every time I watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one that, like, because, you know, as it was pointed out to me today, nobody's seen it. I think more people need to see it. Because, you know, my coworker was like, I've never seen it. Has this person seen it? No, it's not a classic. You know, he was giving me shit.
You know, honestly, if I didn't read a lot of film, I used to read a lot of film writing.
Me too. That's how I know about this movie.
I don't really read it anymore, but if I hadn't read a ton of film writing over the years, I probably wouldn't even know
about
it. Well,
and it's like, I don't read film writing anymore because all film writing today cares about is whether or not stuff's racist or sexist.
Exactly. Well, there is no film writing anymore.
There is no film. It's all the Devin Faraci, like, you don't have to be sexist to hate the new Ghostbusters, but it helps.
Yeah, just hack shit. You know, that no normal person who works for a living would ever read these idiots.
And the thing is like, it's all really lazy writing because it's just designed to marginalize people who disagree with them.
Yes.
Through shame. It's lazy.
It's its own version of the inverted pyramid news writing style. Except it's exactly the same with every stupid jackass opinion. These guys who have never had real jobs, from what I can tell. None of these guys have ever gotten their hands dirty.
You mean J.K. Trotter from Gawker has never held a real job?
No, none of those guys have ever worked.
Devin Faraci? Are you kidding?
No, never. Soft hands. Soft college boy hands from counting
soft
money.
Soft college boy face. He hides it behind a beard for a reason.
Yeah, as Robert Shaw said in Jaws, soft hands from counting money, college boy.
Speaking of Robert Shaw, I got his movie where he plays Custer recently.
I saw it on TV many years ago. It was okay.
I've been on a Custer kick. Like, I've been.
Oh, really? Yeah, it's probably Custer. One of the better movies. There's not a ton of.
And well, really. They Died with Their Boots On with Errol Flynn's another one.
Right? Yeah, that one I've actually never seen. I've seen bits and pieces. You know, I think I was watching on Amazon, and then they turned it into a rental. Like before I was finished with it. So, which they tend to do. They will have these films on for a couple of weeks, like an old Charlton Heston Western you've never heard of. And you might watch an hour of it and then remember, okay, I got to get back to that movie a few days later.
And then you have to pay for it.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, well, screw you. It's like, the hell with that. You know, why did I get this Amazon Prime?
No, but I recently got the Custer Budweiser poster from back in the day that had Custer's last fight, Budweiser. You know, like it was like the poster you would see in every bar. Back in the day, I was like, I don't know, but for some reason, like, I've just been reading a lot about Custer and Little Bighorn, and it's just kind of fascinating to me. I don't know, right. kind of fallout from my Gettysburg trip because of, you know, a lot of people forget that Custer was at Gettysburg and routed Jeb Stuart's attack on the Union line.
Well, nobody knows history.
I know.
You're expecting people to know history. I mean, most people can't tell the difference between the Civil War and the Revolutionary War.
Believe me, it's true.
Or even when I mentioned for the second time we had a war with the British, I think it was the War of 1812.
The War of 1812, yeah.
Where they recruited the pirate Jean Lafitte.
Yep.
To help with the British invasion in New Orleans. It was great. They made one movie out of it. It's okay. It's not a great movie. The Buccaneer. It's the only film.
I need to watch that.
It's the only movie directed by Anthony Quinn. He does not appear in the film. It's the only film he directed.
So he's like Charles Lawton.
It's produced by Cecil B. DeMille, and Charlton Heston plays Andrew Jackson.
Oh, wow.
Yul Brynner is Jean Lafitte. It's enjoyable. It's just not.
Well, that's kind of after the War of 1812, because that would have been like Texas. Well, or no, Andrew Jackson. Well, if he was Andrew Jackson president, but Andrew Jackson was in the War of 1812. Never mind.
Right. So it's Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, because Andrew Jackson fought the Battle of New Orleans. That's where he became really famous.
Right. And it was just sort of, it's the Battle of New Orleans, basically, portrayed. They recruited pirates
Help. When I hear Andrew Jackson, I automatically go to the presidency, and then I go, oh, wait, he had a military career, too. Yes.
but it was like, we watched it in history class one time, and I rewatched it again, I think, via Netflix.
Because Jean Lafitte is something I teach in 7th grade history, because he pops up in Texas history.
Yeah, it's a fun movie because it's, I mean, of course, it's the Cecil B. DeMille version of history. So it,
oh yeah, so it
looks like the way it should have happened, even though it probably wasn't. You know, just like the
right. It's like showing the John Wayne Alamo movie. It's
yeah, cool. Or just like the Ten Commandments, which is one of my favorite movies with Heston as Moses and everything. It's like probably not the way it happened at all. If it happened, but that's the way it should have happened.
Yeah, it's better than the gods in Exodus, whatever fucking Ridley Scott movie we got.
Oh God, I tried to watch that after watching the Ten Commandments and just look like mud.
The only part I liked was the plagues part, just because it was like a Slayer record. Like each plague was very brief and violent.
right. Well, it's kind of like what I say in this. You know, Ridley Scott refuses to make a movie with any color in it.
Oh, I know, it's horrible.
It's kind of similar to how I say Bruce Lee and Enter the Dragon, why that one is always watched by martial artists, and martial artists won't watch most other martial arts films because of the lack of reality or whatever, even though Enter the Dragon is no more realistic than Ali Enter,
Enter the Dragon makes James Bond movies look grounded in reality.
I know, it is, like, but the way the fights look is the way it should look, even though it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like the 13 minutes of fight footage in that film, and that's all it is, Bruce Lee fighting. That's the way it should look, even though it doesn't really look like that.
And, well, anyway.
It's just like Nashville is probably plays up the idea people have of Nashville, even though it's not that interesting. It's basically like the whole Orion documentary had that, the Sun Records guy's daughter saying, you know, everybody in this town can sing. Everybody in this town is writing songs.
Right, you know. Like, you know, you had a lot of untalented people in the movie.
Yeah.
You had, like, people who actually, like, there's that girl who you kind of think is a loser who says she wants to go be a singer in Nashville, and then at the end, it turns out she's really fucking talented.
Yeah.
And blows everybody away and sings at the end. She kind of rallies the crowd. But,
right.
But you have a lot of, like, you know, dumb strippers who want to be singers and stuff. And
oh, yeah. And that actress who played the stripper is dead.
She, oh, really?
She was in Elroy's Rehab, and she had breast cancer and tried to beat it with an organic diet.
Oh well, that always works
instead of actual treatments. Did not last.
Yeah, that, the organic diet. Doesn't usually work.
Macrobiotic diet or something like that. That's how you won't find that on her IMDb.
Yeah, I have a personal story about somebody directly affecting me with their organic diet bullshit that I managed to magically, it got fixed when they started using medication.
Yeah.
Oh my good, that was prescribed by a physician. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, you know how many people in history have beaten cancer with an organic diet?
Zero.
Exactly. it's just like, how many private detectives have solved murder cases? Zilch.
Zilch. Yeah.
How many psychics have solved crimes? Zilch.
That was our thing with Hollywoodland. Like, private detectives are kind of scumbags. You know?
Yeah, they are. They're just divorce. They're basically divorce lawyers without the legal.
They're just there to, you know.
Documentation.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's all they are. They're just scum muckrakers. They're just gathering scum.
So, like, what would you give Nashville?
Give it a 9.
I'd give it a 9 as well. I think it's a classic. If you haven't seen Nashville, you need to watch it.
Yeah, it's a must
watch. And watch it and watch it again. It's one of those movies that, like, you have to see a few times. And I know that sounds like work, but it's not. Like, I have the Criterion Blu-ray, and I think it was worth buying.
I saw it on the big screen and really, really appreciated it in a way I would not enjoy it on home video.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. It's one that I think it's even enjoyable on home video. But you know,
oh, it
but,
probably is. I'll eventually have to pick up the Criterion.
Yeah, it's well worth picking up. But it's one that I say watch it again, because it's one of those movies you just need to watch a few times to get all of it.
Yeah.
Anyway. So yeah, I think we're agreed. It's a 9 out of 10. All right. Do you have anything else, John?
No, nothing else to add to Nashville. I think everybody knows. They need to see it. Great cast. Look it up on IMDb.
Yeah, I mean...
A lot of actors became a bigger deal much later on, like Scott Glenn.
You've got... Jeff
Goldblum. And
Ned Beatty, Karen Black.
Yeah. Karen Black is in there very briefly.
Yeah.
It's funny, she's on all the posters, but she's Lily Tomlin in a really good performance. A very deeply flawed character.
Mm-hmm. That's a character that made me sad.
Yeah, it is. It's really sad. It's like, ugh. But it's just like there's, you know, that movie is closer to life than, you know, Captain America: Civil War.
I hate
to break that to you.
But
all you young kids acting like Civil War is like the greatest film ever made.
Oh boy!
And you overaged middle-aged men.
And the assistant director was Alan Rudolph.
Yes,
who rewrote the script? I think.
Did he?
Yeah, I think Joan Tewksbury is credited as the writer, but I think Alan Rudolph kind of rewrote it to kind of fit what Altman wanted from it.
Right. Well, I think Altman was shacked up with Joan Tewksbury.
Ah.
I think he left his wife and kids.
You know what? I think she might have left her.
Oh yeah, she left kids. She left her family for Robert Altman.
Yeah.
So that tells a lot about their character.
And you know, one of the things that annoys me about Criterion is their New York leftist attitude, because you know, you read the thing and it says that she left her husband and children to go be a script girl on Altman's thing, and they talk about progressive blah blah blah. I'm like, no, that's pretty fucked up. Like,
yeah, she's a piece of shit.
I was like, I that makes her go way down.
She's scum.
You know? Like, she just left her she left her kids and husband behind to go, you know.
Yeah, it's funny how people gloss over that shit like it's nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they act like
that actually makes them sacks of shit.
You know, that's why kids get hooked on drugs and get fucked up and you know, act like Corey Feldman and, you know, get raped by executives.
well, look how they all defended Bill Clinton. And
I don't care what he does in his personal life.
Right, but it's like, it's just, I mean, I wonder how his daughter felt. What was she in, junior high, high school, college?
Hey, like, I don't care what he does in his personal life. It has nothing to do. Oh, that has nothing to do with.
How's that affect the family? Actually, it's great karma.
Actually, you know, there's
things
this thing
today.
There's this thing called character.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Says a lot. Yeah, you know, everybody's. It's disgusting. It's stupid. It's like, and people defend that type of shitty behavior. It's like, come on.
Yep.
It's like scumbags.
It's not no bueno. I take that stuff very seriously, and nobody does today, and it's really sad.
Yeah.
But anyway,
don't hear that type of stuff about John Ford. Don't hear that type of stuff about Howard Hawks.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, even if Howard Hawks was a dirty old man in his dying years with all these nude young women hanging around his mansion, he was like a Hugh Hefner without the magazine.
Well, what was it? I don't know. He sounded like just a nice crotchety old man when Billy Friedkin talked about meeting him when he was dating his daughter.
Yeah. It's like in his dying years when he had a script. And this is what I don't understand is why they don't try to film these scripts. But he had a script about two guys digging for oil like in Texas in the 1920s. And he wanted it the roles to be played by Clint Eastwood and Steve McQueen.
Oh, God.
But, you know, it couldn't be shot by the time he passed. You know, he passed away in, like, you know, in the mid-70s. And so he didn't get around to making it. And I was like, okay, so there's an unfilmed Howard Hawks script. I think there's a couple of unfilmed Hitchcock scripts. Like, why doesn't somebody try to option those instead of, you know, remaking movies that are perfectly fine or this type of creative doldrums are in these days?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Michael Mann had no problem basically rewriting the screenplay of the 1920 silent version of Last of the Mohicans and have the biggest hit they'll ever have. And it's just like, why don't they go back and go to these old scripts that were written in the golden age of movie making or by truly talented, you know, some of the greatest directors.
If you want great dialogue, some of those old Hawk scripts are out of this world.
Perfect. And he would get Lee Brackett to give it a pass. Or William Faulkner would script doctor him.
It gets
no better.
Talking about Hawks always makes me want to go watch Red River again.
Yeah, I'll even watch something like El Dorado or any of those again. You know,
yeah, Rio Bravo, which should be an MMC episode.
That'll be
Stuart.
That'll be an upcoming episode if the Australian gets it. But
God damn it. Anyway,
yeah, it's just like go back to the classics and film those. Quit fucking buying options to comic books and stuff. It's like,
well,
so let's make movies again. Yeah. Movies are dead.
They really are, because, you know, like, what was it? Somebody recently was describing the studios as a shell. And I was like, yeah, pretty much.
Anthony Nesbitt, one of our listeners, said, you know, he was quoting Steve Shagan. He says studios are just banks.
They are. It's just that they pick up movies and, you know, they just invest in these they want the surefire hit. Nashville was made at a time when studios didn't really know what they were doing, and so they let stuff like this happen. You could never make a movie like this today.
But also back then, they knew they were making movies.
Yeah, no, exactly.
They knew they were making movies. They weren't making some product that you could have, you know, kids' bedsheets and video games based on. They were making movies.
They want those products.
We're filling the theaters with movies for adults to go see. It's just that mentality is non-existent.
Well, and there's been a big shift where it's all about the youth market.
Yeah.
Like my dad said, he hates going to stores and he hates going out in public because he says everything's geared towards 13-year-old girls. And so you get 13-year-old girl music, you get 13-year-old girl aesthetic, you get 13-year-old girl everything because they spend the most money. Mm-hmm. And he said that's why he hates going to like retail outlets, because he said it's not geared towards people like him. And frankly, it makes sense. They want to make money and they focus group it to who spends the most money. But
it's true. It's like, very true.
But it's also really bad for the culture.
It is. The culture is, there is no culture.
There is no culture anymore. It's gone.
It's mall, globalist mall culture.
It is a mall culture. And I hate, I fucking hate going to the mall.
I hate shopping malls. I hate
going to see a movie at the mall.
I hate
it with a mall crowd.
Yeah, I hate globalism. I hate all that stuff. It's just like,
you know, I don't like, I like culture. And we're all the same. It's the death of culture. And it prevents movies like Nashville from existing.
It does. It truly does. It's like, it's weird. The liberal film of 1975 would be basically, you know, an individualistic libertarian movie today.
It would be. And that's not trying to co-opt it, people.
No.
This is just true.
I'm not saying Ayn Rand would be all crazy about this movie, but it's just like it would be viewed differently today. Same thing with The Rockford Files.
Yeah.
If you watch Rockford Files back in the 70s was considered a liberal detective show. Now you would watch it and think it was conservative.
Because
it's all about these things like corporations spying on us, all these things liberals don't care about anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They really don't. It's just like all the stuff, the NSA and everything, they don't care about that stuff.
No.
And but if you watch a Rockford Files, you'd be surprised that it doesn't really seems more of the conservative, individualistic thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's probably why I'm just not really enthusiastic about new product these days.
No, I'm not either. I mean, I don't go to the theaters hardly at all anymore. I'm going to go see The Nice Guys this weekend, that's for sure.
After I saw Civil War in an empty theater, I actually saw it in 3D in an empty theater. Do you know how weird I felt pulling out the peanut M&Ms that I snuck into the theater, and I'm the only one in there? And I realized, okay, this stuff is saturating the theaters. There's too many screens showing this. There should be a revival series at this multiplex or a better usage of this screen than just showing this film again.
Yeah, this. I mean, surely they could use that time to show something else.
Yes, and I was just like, I can't. This is the only time in my history of movie going, seriously, and I've seen some obscure crap that some people didn't even know got a theatrical release. It's just like, why is this the only time I'm the only person in this screening? I'm the only one there. It is bizarre. And I paid way too much money. Because I went, you know, it was, I had a night to do something. I went and saw this. It had the most convenient time. Mm-hmm. Regret it. The movie wasn't that good. It's, I know it's getting rave reviews. It's not that good. I just realized movies are dead to me. It's like, I love The Nice Guys. Go see it. Please support The Nice Guys. Go see this thing. Make it a sleeper hit. Give Shane Black a boost. The Nice Guys is what I want to see more of, but it's not happening.
It's like, but it's just, I think it's crazy when I say, when I see somebody like James Rolfe say, I'm not going to go see the new Ghostbusters movie, which if you watch his videos, he's a massive Ghostbusters fan. And he's not even a guy who's like tuned into political culture. Like he's kind of a savant, you know, it's just, it's not his thing. He does that and people, you know, flip out. It just shows how in the thrall we are of this corporate movie culture.
Right. Oh my God. Go see the small product.
Go see this fucking, this soulless excuse to sell toys.
Let's defend corporate shit on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just one of these things where he says, I'm not going to go see it because I don't want to support something I don't want to see with my money. I wish more people said that because then these movies, but so many nerds want to be in on the conversation. I have to see the latest movie.
You know who I would like to, among our nerd cultists, is like all these guys who say they hate Stan Lee because they think he stole everything from Jack Kirby, or he wouldn't give Jack Kirby the credit or ownership of his career. Well, then don't go see the fucking Marvel
movies. Don't give him money then.
You know, even if they settled with the Kirby descendants, Jack didn't see any of that money. Don't go see the fucking movies.
Yeah.
You know, don't go see anything with Spider-Man in it until they roll up the Brinks truck for Steve Ditko, who would probably refuse the money anyway.
No, exactly. I mean, it's one of these things where the outrage that was attached to it was so stupid and so irrational, because it was all I was reading the whole time was obey your corporate masters. It was like I felt like Roddy Piper wearing the sunglasses.
Well, because they made a Ghostbusters movie full of ugly women.
Yeah.
So they've basically.
I don't know if this is a race thing or a gender thing, but I'm fucking pissed. Oh wow, what the height of humor we've had.
Wow, you know what I liked about Ernie Hudson in the old film, he wasn't a stereotype.
Yes.
A blue collar sensible guy who actually kept the team grounded.
Here's the thing about Ghostbusters is the changes they've done have changed the DNA of Ghostbusters to where it's not Ghostbusters anymore.
Right.
Ghostbusters is about fucking knucklehead guys doing knucklehead guy shit, fighting ghosts, and fighting the government. Now it's about PC women doing PC woman shit and loving the government.
Yeah, and they're going to be on Ellen with Hillary Clinton to promote it.
That's exactly. Really, it's the exact
opposite.
Oh, that's
really going to help your case now.
Do you think that that Kristen Wiig's going to look into the camera and say, this man has no dick? You know, to Hillary Clinton? No.
Nah,
but Dr. Peter Venkman would.
Exactly. Because it's a Bill Murray movie.
Yeah.
You can't remake Bill Murray movies. Bill Murray of that time was the funniest man in the world. You can't, and he was a guy. It's like, you can't do that now. It's like, Bill Murray's become an indie movie guy who's not even funny anymore. So, but it's like, people don't understand, in the 80s, Bill Murray was the funniest guy in the world.
And he turned his back on that success.
He totally turned his back on it.
He did.
Makes an unfunny movie called The Razor's Edge, adapting the classic novel. Just goes to school in Paris for several years.
What was it? The Nerd did a follow-up video where he was to his, like, I won't go see Ghostbusters video, where he did the history of Ghostbusters 3. Mm-hmm. And he kind of was like, Bill Murray won't do Ghostbusters 3, but he's going to be in this movie. And he was kind of like, you know, he was expressing some anger over, like, that he wouldn't do it, and then Harold Ramis dies, and all of a sudden he's showing up in this, you know?
Yeah, well, Ghostbusters 2 sucks so bad, I'm kind of glad that he didn't make Ghostbusters 3. And I don't even know if Ghostbusters would hold up if I watched it now. I figure the pacing might be annoying.
Oh, I like it. I always like it when I watch it.
Yeah, gotta remember I'm on the dark side of 43.
I know. I'm sure when I'm your age, I'll be pissed off all the time.
Oh, you're gonna hate half the stuff you love when you were young. Really will.
No, it's funny because I hate a lot of the stuff I used to love now when I rewatch it. So it's just gonna get
worse.
Wait
till you get to your 40s.
It's gonna be worse. It's gonna be so much worse.
Oh man, so much of my DVD shelf is in a duffel bag, ready to go be traded in. I have to drive all the way to Colorado Springs to get decent trade-in.
It got to where, like, I have students who will, like, be like, oh, Mr. Deusing, have you seen blah, blah, blah? And I'd sit there and think, when I was their age, yes, now, no. And I just sit there and I think, do I shit on it now, or do I just let them find out? And I think, I'll let them find out.
Yeah. You know what I end up liking these days? Abbott and Costello movies. And you know what I liked? You know what I liked about The Nice Guys? It's an Abbott and Costello movie.
Yeah,
that's
it
all
looks
it
like
really
one.
Is.
Looks like
that's
one.
What. That's exactly what
and
it
it's
is.
It's a better movie than Iron Man 3, I'm sure.
Oh, hell, way better. It's better than any Marvel movie. Period.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll put it over any of that stuff. I mean, it's everything I like. So
good.
You know, it works. It's in it, and as I told Stu, and he actually sounded interested. I said, "Hey, it's the one good Russell Crowe performance out of 10 movies."
Just forget about the Rabbitohs and
right. Every 10 years, you get one good Russell Crowe performance, and this is it.
Well, I think we're about tapped out.
Sure. This is a perfect one for release on Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, Memorial Day weekend, Nashville. Go for Memorial Day weekend. Get the family together. Well, don't get the family together because this movie has a lot of nudity. But not a lot. But
no, it's not a family.
It's not a family movie. I was just going to say.
And by the way, anyone under 20 will hate this film.
Yes. So let me amend that. Get the family together, have a cookout, and then put the kids to bed and get the like-minded adults together and watch this.
Yes, watch an adult film for once. Watch a movie with grown-ups.
Watch a movie that has grown-up music and grown-up themes and all that good stuff.
Right.
I like my geek stuff as much as anybody else, but it's oversaturated. It's too much. We need to get back to this, the Criterion Collection.
No, yeah. Not boy. Wait till we do the Woody Allen episode.
Oh Jesus! Oh fuck! Are we gonna have Corey Feldman on that one?
Oh man, can we get him? We might be able to get him now. We've had some guys that we were gonna ask to be on this show, and then they got too big.
Yeah.
Literally, as the show was being recorded, these characters got too big. It's like,
you get
Joe
Carducci.
We could probably still get him.
We could get him.
Yeah, he did the show. We just gotta figure out how to technically hook it up and record the show.
Yeah, he used to work for SST, so that's I think in it literally just has solid state transistor.
But I think eventually we could get these people on. Yeah. But just gotta work on it.
So go to MidnightMovieCowboys.com, look us up on iTunes, Facebook, leave us a review on iTunes, 5 stars, just if you want to support the show, that's a great way to do it.
Yeah, and it's a suggestion.
Look us up on Stitcher. Stuart will be back next week, and we will kick off Rock Month. So next month, Nashville, being a country music movie, sort of a soft launch, I would say.
Yeah, and also check out PhantomSway.com.
PhantomSway.com.
PhantomSway.com, second carrying. It's a site that carries our show on Mondays. And they are running a short film festival, horror-themed. I think the winners are going to be screened at the horror film festival this fall in Colorado. And we'll have more details about that later.
Cool.
But check out their website. I think they've already got some stuff up. And if you're a up-and-coming short horror filmmaker, check it out. Might be a good opportunity for you, even though we barely ever cover horror films. So.
Right. I saw a horror movie in the theater last weekend.
You did?
I did.
Judas.
I know. Well, here's the thing. I was talking about dating with you guys on the show last week.
Oh, okay.
You guys said, stop letting me go to my things. Let the woman pick, okay?
Girls always love horror movies.
And she wanted to go see a horror movie. Now, had a great time. The movie was a piece of shit. It was horrible.
Uh-huh.
But nobody was in the theater, and we were just making fun of it the whole time. It was great.
Oh, what was it?
The Darkness with Kevin Bacon.
Oh. See, I only know that as a really cool band out of England.
I know, me too. It's Stewart's favorite band.
They had nothing on the soundtrack?
No, nothing. It was like, it was one of those Blumhouse productions, but it was like somebody wrote a script where they went, okay, what is Blumhouse like? Family in Crisis, check. Ancient Evil, check. Children in Peril, check. Okay, let's go. Horrible. Fucking awful.
Oh, the same company.
But it has to do with Indians, so I'm sure Low Fidelity loves it. But
well, they just wrote like a blank check to John Carpenter to have his name on the next Halloween film.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, Blumhouse is doing that. Yeah, so it's going to be like... They needed the money!
Carpenter needed the money!
Hickory Dickory Dock, John Carpenter set on this.
He's still chain smoking cigarettes. The prices have gone up.
but no, it's gonna be there's gonna be a family in peril, and then Michael Myers is gonna show up and like kidnap one of the kids or something.
I'm sure
it's gonna be the plot because it's Blumhouse. But no, it was actually a fun time. But it was just funny. I went to see it. I was like, this movie's awful. I was like, let's go see The Nice Guys. And she was like, what about The Darkness? And I was like, okay, fine.
Oh man, you almost saw The Nice Guys.
I'm gonna see it this weekend.
All right, yeah, you're gonna love it.
Yeah. All right. On that note, anything else, John?
That's it.
All right. Make America great again. Adios.
Yeah. Mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.